Good evening, everybody. We're starting with the Connect the Dots, and Charlie should be here in just a moment. And tonight, I thought we would spend some time talking about observing limits. So hopefully Charlie will be here in a moment. I know he's got a lot of thoughts on this, too. And Terry, I'm wondering if you were willing, while we're waiting for Charlie to join, if you want to give a heads up about any of the upcoming program that is planned.
Oh, sure. Thank you. That's very nice. Well, there's a two-day conference in Boston. It's actually under the auspices of an organization that's really relatively new. This is their first event that they're doing, and we're co-sponsoring it. It's 2 days. It's April 20th and 21st. It's being headed by Dr. Mary Zanarini at McLean Hospital. And registrations, you can find out more information about going on our website. So in May, we have a conference at Yale. And in the fall, we have a few things on the line that we're working on that we're very excited about, one in the country and one out of the country. So that's for this coming, but will bring us to the end of the year.
Mm. You have so many good programs running. It's really exciting.
Well, thanks to you, to the professionals like you, Kelly, that we can do all of this.
Well, welcome everybody. We're getting started here in just one moment. Having a few technical difficulties here as Charlie joins the line.
I'll take a minute to encourage people who are on the line to give donations. As you know, we're a nonprofit. We're all volunteer. And if you're benefiting in any way from any of these calls, we would be most appreciative if you'd think to go on our website.
But this should be fine. And, I've been listening
great.
For a few minutes.
Hey, Charlie.
Hi. Sorry, I've been sitting listening to everything, unable to. I've been muted. So.
I bet your family wishes they could do that when you start to nag about homework and whatnot.
yes. If they think that I'm confusing family life with running a workshop, they do that. I'm sorry. I don't know why this happened this way. But anyway, here I am.
No worries. So here we are. And I thought tonight we could talk some about observing limits. That was the topic that was sort of most on my mind. And I wondered, you know, Charlie, if you're up for it, I thought I might ask people who are on the line to do a little reflection even before we get into talking about it and just think about, maybe even grab a piece of paper if you want, but and something to write with, but just think for a minute about one area or way in which it's difficult for you to observe your limits or where it might benefit you and others in your life if you are better at observing limits.
That sounds good.
Yeah. People want to give that some thought. And so, you know, I would just give an example, and maybe, Charlie, you could give one from a clinical situation of one of your limits. But, for example, one limit that I'm working on observing better right now is not taking on new projects and really developing my ability to say no to things in a smooth and easy manner. And so that would be one limit of mine. How about you? Do you have one that's kind of a clinical example?
I think it comes up. There's one person that I have worked with over the years who a limit has to do. I guess when I know that there's a problem with limits, usually I start to have some sort of negative feeling about it. And there's sometimes I've had the problem where. So I'm more flexible than is good for me in the long run in allowing somebody to come late.
Mm-hmm.
So much that and it's really tricky one because it's a person for whom that is a huge life problem. There's all kinds of ways to understand it and try to change it that we've worked on. It's been very hard to change. I don't see it as anything he or she is doing willfully. It's just sort of there, and it's part of who the person is. And then when it doesn't leave enough time to really do much work together, that starts to get to me. So it's figuring out when, you know, I think often figuring out a limit, whether it's clinically or as a parent or as a friend or a colleague, I think, you know, it's how do you take care of the other person, and especially if it's a clinical situation where it's your job to be helping them, and how do you take care of yourself so that you don't take on or deal with more than you can deal with, you know, and then it ends up. It ends up haunting the treatment. So that's one.
That's a great. I think that's a great example, and it sort of leads into what I thought I might do is spend a little bit of time just talking about some of the ideas with limits. Like, what is a limit anyway? And I thought I might share a little bit of thoughts and then move more into a dialogue, because I know this is an area that you've thought a lot about. And then go back and forth, and this is where I wish, and maybe people can send us feedback as they have done in the past, because I'd be very curious, you know, what people take away and what strikes them as useful. So I was thinking about, you know, how would I define what is a limit, and you know, I was thinking about how the experience of a limit actually ranges from like a little blip of discomfort, or like I think of it almost as a speed bump, like I'm going along and then there's a bump or a disruption in the interaction in some way, in my emotions. You know, like somebody stands a little too close, or wears more perfume and we're traveling in a closed car, or borrows a book and then returns it in a, you know, not great shape, or all the way up to the more intense, like a sense of violation or real anger that somebody's actually trespassing on my rights or really imposing on my freedom. And the more I think about limits, that kind of experience of that discomfort, I really think of them as quite individual and different from person to person. So, I was thinking about, I once taught a big class on observing limits. There were probably 100 people in a hotel room, and we just did a little exercise to see how different things were. And I asked people, you know, like if there's a little sense of discomfort with something I was doing, I wanted them to imagine I was a new client. This is our first meeting. And they would just raise a finger if they were a little uncomfortable, all the way to if they were really uncomfortable, they would raise their hand straight up, like a first grader, you know, who can't wait to speak. And so I said to them, I started and I said, you know, so can you tell me some about your professional background? And I was surprised, like some people, therapists actually raised their finger at that. Like that was a little past their limits. And then I asked, you know, one of the things I'm struggling with and I want to work on is, you know, I'm divorced and now I'm a stepmother, and I'm wondering about, you know, do you have kids and have you been divorced? And a few more hands went up. And then I asked, and I also, my last therapist really had difficulty with understanding side effects. Like they really didn't get how big an issue that was for me with my medication. And we had quite a few struggles about that. And so I kind of wonder, like, side effects. Yeah, from taking medication. And so I said, you know, have you ever had to take psychotropic medications like antidepressants yourself? And then like a lot more people's hands went up. And then I asked, right, the coffee service start to come in, and they were laying out the coffee. So there's all of a sudden an influx of hotel staff. And I asked my next question, which was, And the other thing I really struggle with is, you know, internet pornography. And I just wonder, have you ever used internet pornography? And then everybody's hands went up, which, of course, the hotel staff probably had a hard time sorting out. So, but it was like, it was fascinating.
Big surprise. Everybody's disciplining themselves so well that they get on the internet and avoid, you know, that huge number of sites.
Yeah.
Right.
So that was, I just feel like watching people's fingers and hands go up to different things some people's hands didn't even go up at a client asking, had you ever used internet pornography? They really had very wide limits. Like, that did not feel intrusive. It didn't cross any personal sense of anything. And then other people, even asking about professional background, felt like it was a little bit off. It made their kind of antenna go up. So I just think the first concept about limits is it's really individually different. What feels uncomfortable all the way up to what really feels like a violation amongst us. And I think there's a way sometimes therapists are trained as if there was a, you know, a rule book somewhere about what is appropriate and what is not appropriate, as opposed to it being a more individual difference. So maybe I would even pause, you know, like little simple things like calling somebody by their first name versus Mr. or Mrs. or Doctor. You know, that kind of small things around manners, around what's okay and not okay to talk about and the way in which to talk about it. Like, they're just so different amongst people. So what? Maybe I would pause there, Charlie. What do you think about this first idea of just it being so different amongst people?
Well, I'll tell you, I really like the way you said that about we live as if there are rule books about these things. I think that therapists live with a sense of what is the rule book, and there's a lot of reason that people would think that. It's not a crazy thought. There's all kinds of concerns about ethics and concerns about professional practice, and in most models of treatments compared to DBT, there's sort of a lot of discussion about boundaries. Certainly my own background in psychoanalytic treatment before I started learning DBT, you know, we really focused a lot on what the boundaries, what the frame of the relationship, what kind of is acceptable, what's not acceptable, how do you address it. But it was very, you know, it was really the setting limits concept, and there was more a sense that across patients, the same boundaries or rules would apply across over time, from 1 week or 1 month or 1 year to the next. More or less, with the exception of extreme situations, more or less the same rules and boundaries will apply, right? And across different patients at the same time, across one patient over a year or two, with some flexibility. But by and large, the concept was that there is a kind of like a set of boundaries and limits that are appropriate and that are the right things that are therapeutic. And I think in DBT, and I think in more matching like life in general, though actually as parents, I find a lot of us have rules similarly, but it is this sense that you really have to figure this out. You have to actually observe your own limits, and you almost never know what your own limits are until they are violated.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, oh, you know, but then another person violates supposedly the same limits, and it doesn't feel as violating. It doesn't, it isn't a problem with someone else, or it isn't a problem. You know, I'll give you a little example. There's a lot of clinical examples. It's like, because I think this is like everyday stuff. This is stuff we do every day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You go in to buy a cup of coffee, and on one day, you have broad limits. You talk to the person next to you. The person selling you the coffee makes a comment. Somebody says something annoying. Somebody makes you wait, and you're kind of like, you're on a good mood. You're in a good day.
Mm-hmm.
And your limits are pretty broad, just the way they are clinically sometimes. And then on another day, you can't take one thing. I mean, it's like you want to get in there, get your coffee, and get out, you know, and everybody is crossing your limits. So what I like about the concept of observing limits, but I think it makes it add up to what it really is, which is it's an advanced skill in life. I mean, it's really a complex, advanced skill if you take on the responsibility of actually noticing your limits, noticing that they change across people, across time, across situations, across moods. and figure out what to do about that so that you aren't just living in a chaotic way where somebody never knows what to expect from you, but also you aren't living in a way that's like so rigid and arbitrary that it's like, you know, the other there's no room to extend your limits sometimes, or to just be variable. So I think it's very challenging, and I just want to link, because I know a lot of parents listen to this too. Well, and a lot of us are parents, but I mean a lot of people who are parents of people who have difficulties listen, and I've done just a lot of thinking about how this is just as critical and challenging as a parent as as a therapist. I mean, what do you do when your kid is doing things that clearly, is a little beyond just kind of like something that's bothering you a little bit, and how do you handle that in an effective way? How do you, so I think it's directly related to burnout as a therapist and burnout as a parent and burnout in life. Concept is everywhere, and it's an advanced skill, and I think that the real intention when Linehan developed Observing Limits in DBT was that it's almost something like accessing wise mind. So you really, it's your wise mind limits as opposed to your arbitrary limits or your rule book. And that is a challenge. I think that's a challenge.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to come back maybe for a second, because I think the concept of observing versus setting limits is actually new, or maybe may not be as familiar to people. And I think sometimes the idea of setting limits actually comes from a well-intended place and maybe necessary, so not to be absolute about it. But I think the way I understand setting limits is it's the intent of setting limits is somehow focused on constraining or stopping the other's behavior. And often setting limits is, it's almost like problems are considered due to something that's maladaptive or you know, the person has poor boundaries or that. And so you're trying to help that other person get the hang of how to be interpersonally appropriate by, you know, helping them establish the sense of self, like, you know, here's where you end and here's where I start and that. And so I think, you know, setting limits sometimes can have that more helpful running into contingency sort of feel to it. It may be a rule, but it's still offered, and it may be arbitrary, but it's still offered with that spirit. Whereas other times I think setting limits, at least on the experiencing somebody else setting a limit, it's like a Heisman trophy, you know, like, or a running back that stiff arms you, you know, or one of those things where the bully puts their hand on your forehead and holds you at distance as if you're, you know, toxic or harmful. And so I think sometimes the experience of somebody setting a limit is really pretty aversive, and you get set up as if you are the problem. Whereas I think the spirit, at least to me, the spirit of observing limits is more like it's a natural interpersonal difference. Like, we are different in how much intimacy we want. We are different in how often we want to shower, you know. We're different in all kinds of ways. And it's more about this interpersonal fit and how we're going to negotiate it when what I need and want is different than what you need and want in this relationship. So I think of observing limits as more about being able to skillfully describe that difference in interpersonal fit, and that happens across all relationships, not just in therapy. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, a couple different things came to mind. One is that this was a big topic when I developed an inpatient program using DBT, because inpatient, I mean, the word setting limits is just constant in inpatient work, as well as all kinds of other work, but it's very heavy there. You set limits on this, you set limits on that. And I think in the old not just the old days, I think really everywhere, most of the time, people are practicing with the spirit of setting limits. And the spirit of setting limits is just like you said, it's I need to put limits on this behavior because this behavior is part of a pathological process. This behavior is part of a set of problems, and I'm going to help this person avoid getting into trouble and learn how to cope with the appropriate limits. I think it's a very parent-child. It can be very condescending. It can be very arrogant, and it can be experienced that way, even if it's not intended that way. It's this one-up, one-down position of setting limits. But I'll tell you what helped me when I started thinking. It's sort of like the dialectic between setting limits and observing limits. When I started to realize that to set limits on in my program, let's say the limits on the amount of physical contact between individual patients with each other or with the staff, that was a tough one because for a lot of people, maybe all of us in different ways, when you're really suffering and you're in a crisis or you're just demoralized, you're depressed, you're anxious, physical contact can be so helpful. I mean, so soothing, and it can be, it can really work for you. Okay, so for reasons that have nothing to do with whether it's good for you, we would set a limit, and that was part of the rules of our program, that you couldn't do that. And then I realized that when I explained it to some patients who would be upset about it, the turning point was when I realized it really, it's really observing my limits as the chief. The limits that were set on the unit were actually not me observing limits. I was not willing, personally, given the rules of the hospital, which was bigger than me, given the rules of ethical conduct that all kinds of professional organizations were coming down with, and given all kinds of other concerns, I realized I was taking away something valuable. So that when patients would ask me from then on, I'd say, look, let me just tell you, this limit exists for my sake. This is because I have to be the one that is in the middle ground between hospital rules and our inpatient rules, between ethical boundaries that are defined in organizations and what's being done here, and other things where people make people go crazy about physical contact, even if it's benign. And so this pre-existed you. It has nothing to do, in a sense, with you, and you are, in some ways, a sort of an innocent bystander and a victim of this. But I've got to observe these, and my staff is going to continue to observe these limits. And it took away the people might disagree, but it's a totally different kind of disagreement. They felt this, I guess it, you'd consider it like a disagreement, respectful disagreement. Like, they'd say, oh, okay. You're not telling me that I need contact too much. You're not telling me that I'm a pathologically needy person. You're not telling me that I don't have boundaries. You're telling me that you're doing this to preserve your inpatient program. Exactly. And then it was like, oh, all right, I could live with that. That was like the essence of the difference.
I think that spirit, the ability to phrase a limit in terms of one's own personal boundaries, versus a problem with the other is a key in the difference between setting versus observing limits. Just think of the difference in phrasing, even something simple like you shouldn't smoke by, you know, in here or something like that versus, you know, I'd prefer not to inhale the smoke. Like it's just so different when it's phrased in terms of preserving my limits as a person, as opposed to you're bad, you should know better, you know, stop.
I think we do apply, I mean, I think limit setting is another term for punishment. It's bringing aversive consequences to a behavior. And, you know, in mental health treatment, people seem a lot more comfortable calling it limit setting than calling it punishment. But it has the same rules. It's sort of like if you do this, you know, you're going to have this consequence. That's, and it's an aversive consequence, and that's usually punishment. So And I think there are places for punishment, but I think it gets way overused and people kind of sneak in a lot of punishment and control and aversive conditioning under the name of limit setting, which somehow preserves a good name in mental health. And so I think it has to be used, but used judiciously and watched. And I just would think another example that within a family context, I was thinking in preparation for this, like, where does this come up for me? And I realized every day.
Yes, exactly.
Two dogs. How much am I willing to walk the dogs? How much am I willing to drive my kids around? How much am I willing to put up with a lot of noise that I don't want to hear? And, you know, a very focal one is that my 14-year-old, he wants to basically listen to music 24 hours a day if he could. I mean, and it's music. And I'd say a large percentage of his music is sort of overstimulating to me. I mean, it's like, you know, it's rap, it's hip-hop, but it's sometimes really harsh, and sometimes I can't even understand the musical value of it. But, of course, that's what my parents said about my music. And so, you know, we get in the car, and every time, and I drive him to school, because his high school is close to on my way to work. I drop him off. Every time he gets in the car, no matter what we're doing, the question in the air is, can I listen to my music? You know, and I didn't bring my headphones. So can I plug it in, it's my iPod, into the car? And it's like, we both know that. And then, but I've really learned over time, first, I really can observe my limits, even though I have enormous sympathy for him wanting to listen to music. I think it's great. And I don't want to stop him from it. But, you know, he's gotten trained and I've gotten trained, so he respectfully will say, so could I listen to my music? And I'll say, on a given day, I'll say, no, you can't. I'm not in the frame of mind to listen to it. I'm sorry. And another day, I'll say, it depends what it is. It will put me over the top if it's some of the music you listen to. He'll say, oh, I know what you mean. And then other times I'll be in a state of mind that's like, put anything on you want. I mean, this is great. You and me, what could be better? Driving along when you're in a good mood and you're resilient and you're not overstressed. This is great. And then other times, I don't want to hear it, but we're on the way for him to play a hockey game. And this brings in another element where you are assessing the value to the other person. And he'll say, Dad, I need to get pumped up for the game. And, you know, I know that phenomenon, and so I say, okay, we could do it, but give me a couple minutes, and then we'll do it. So, I mean, I think this kind of thing that goes on there with him goes on all the time, and you can burn out as a parent if you have a kid that you can't do that with, or that you don't do that with, or you don't feel you should do that with. Or you do that too much with, and then the kid is always pissed off at you for it. And if you have a kid with a lot of problem behaviors, it's just it's a challenge. You could have a whole therapy group, a support group for parents on how to observe limits, and that would be a huge good thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I totally know what you mean. I think the difficulty of being able to observe your limits and feel free to observe them because the other person will have an intense reaction to it. And really, you know, the kind of coercive patterns that get going, it's just so painful. Because you know if you don't observe it, things are going to go bad. But you know if you do observe it, things are going to go bad. It's really difficult figuring out how to phrase it. You know, I think sometimes the difficulty is knowing that you're actually crossed your limits. Like, you may not even realize it until it's done. And then you think, ooh, that was a problem. I need to talk to the person about that. But other times you do know, it's just finding the words about, you know, how to phrase it, what you want to say. You know, is it going to be on the fly or is it going to be more of a real heart-to-heart? I think that is thinking about the different places I turn when I'm really stuck, you know, trying to find the words and Do you know Marshall Rosenberg, the nonviolent communication?
I know about that. I don't know. I'm not trained in that, but yes, I know about that.
Yeah. I studied that for a while, and that website has some just fabulous ways of helping translate, you know, what you want to say back into this respectful, you know, from my side of things, here's what matters to me. And then and being able to find a way to say that while, and I guess this is one of the things I wanted to talk with you about to see if you do it too. I think when things are most difficult for me about worrying about the other's perspective, or I actually have the strongest reactions to having my limits crossed, I often will do like a really focused, before I say anything, I will do a really focused effort on really trying to get what is it like for the other person really to need what they need and then to run into me not being able to give what they want or to have a problem with what, you know, their natural ways. Like in a very mindful, you know, like they really putting myself through my paces of they need and want exactly what they need and want for very good reasons until I'm like steeped in empathy. And then from that position, then I might think about how I want to say what I want to say about my limits. Does that make sense, or what do you, when you're really in those tough ones?
No, I've done exactly that, and I find when I supervise other therapists, it comes up all the time, too, for them, and then trying to help them think of, it sounds like really the way your phone contact is going with this person, it's just not working very well. I mean, either you're getting more calls than you can take, and you think you should take them because it's part of DBT treatment model or some other treatment model, or you just should be a humane person and there's values involved, or you're having phone calls but they actually aren't turning into any good changes in behavior, and so you're wondering what you're doing, and then you're in a bad mood, and then. You know, and people, I think generally therapists start out trying to be heroes, feeling like we are in this field because we really are trying to change people's lives. I mean, I think that would be like 99% of therapists. I mean, that's where you start out. And so then you focus on the person's life and you feel like this person needs to feel safe. So they need a lot of contact with me, or this person actually makes pretty good use of this sometimes. So how else can they change? Or you misunderstand some, you know, guru therapist saying that you should take every call or something, and you get stuck. And so, you know, finding a way, especially once you have been allowing your kind of natural internal intuitive limits to be violated repeatedly. Once you get in that position, it's really tough to find a way out. You really often, I think, need the help of another person, a team member, a therapist, someone to talk to who's wise, and then you end up going to somebody and you say, look, I want to tell you something. I've been in this position. Look, I've got to tell you something. I've been doing you a huge disservice, and I mean that in the most sincere way. I've been allowing you to do this, that, or the other, whether it's certain kind of phone calls or not, you know, skipping sessions. Or I had one teenage patient once many years ago who used to show up every session. She'd bring a different friend and just walk in. And I had to figure out, well, what's my limit about this? Because friends were really important to her, and I was pleased that she was wanting me to get to know her friends, but the way it was being handled. So I had to have a talk with her and said, I've been doing a big disservice because I'm of two minds about this. One is that this is great. I love that you bring your friends in, and they mean so much to you. It's almost like having your friends in is like having part of yourself here. Absolutely, she says. Yeah, that's who I live through, my friends. And I've realized, though, that I haven't been speaking up and telling you that another side of this is what would it be like for you and me to be just talking with each other sometimes, even about your friends or about other things? And I feel that I'm not doing you a service by not telling you this. So I would like to ask that we start to make a certain number of our sessions clearly that. So it was tough for me. I there was a lot of preparation to think about how to do this in a way that was really just accurate, and it was compassionate. And then that worked pretty well, but I've had other examples where I just, you know, I'm a little frustrated, I'm a little done in, I'm a little demoralized about something, and I haven't really gotten into Wise Mind about how to speak about it. And I do something that sounds more like that concept of setting a limit and with some punitiveness in my tone of voice. You know, it can't be mistaken. I mean, you know, when people say you're being punitive, chances are you are.
Yeah, but I think it's hard. I think you're exactly right. It's sometimes very hard to detect your own condescension or tightness, you know, where, you know, even though the content of what you're saying is, you know, clear, the feeling tone behind it really is saying you're the problem to the other person. Just think it's really hard. I thought a lot about that, too, of, you know, like, how do you get the spirit? And I think you're pointing to really needing to get consultation or at practice, you know, rehearse, say what you're going to say, get clear about it.
You need to rehearse sometimes. In the tough ones, you need to rehearse. And I was thinking about how do you change that? How do you get better at this? I mean, if this is a valuable thing that helps prevent burnout as a family member or as a therapist or anyone else, how do you get better at it when you're not very good at it, either because you're very accommodating, you really are willing to bend over backwards because you really care about people and you've just, that's part of who you are, or you've been trained that way, or you modeled yourself after someone. How do you, and then you find that it backfires on you because you actually are swallowing a lot, and later it comes up to haunt you and the other person. So how do you do that without, on the other hand, becoming so arbitrary that every time you experience discomfort, you say, I'm sorry, you're violating my limits, you know, you can't do that. And it's like, you know, so that you create a completely rigid, hierarchical, arbitrary environment that's terrible. And I think that you do it by practicing and by trying to rehearse, by trying to get support from somebody else about what kind of limits make sense for you as well as for the person you care about. But really for you, it's really that, you know, it's been said a million times when people talk about observer limits that it really is like putting on your own, what is it called, the mask, the oxygen mask if the plane is having
And
before you put that on your child. I mean, you've got to have your own resilience. You've got to take care of yourself or else it's going to hurt everybody. And I speak this a lot better than I do it because I take on too much work all the time. It pushes me to the edge so much of the time that then I get arbitrary. And somebody says, well, can you do this? And my tone of voice is almost like, how dare you ask me to do that? It's like, and it's a perfectly innocent request. It just came after I had accepted too many. And I think a lot of people in our field do this. We take on too much. Parents, you know, just get in a habit. And it's deep as a parent because you feel so committed to your kid. You just don't want to turn them down too much, or you think you don't want to be too harsh, but then you end up being even more harsh because you haven't. And the other thing I want to say is that I think that the reason I connect this to Wise Mind is that as I thought more deeply about the observing limits part of being a therapist or being a doctor, as well as being a parent, I think there is a certain kind of, just like in mindfulness practice, you want to cultivate a sense of freedom. And I think the more you can observe limits the way we're talking about in a relationship, the more you cultivate the sense of genuineness, directness, openness and freedom, so that you, the way I mean, I gave the example of my son and the music in the car, I get, you know, that is a great example for me to explain because it's gone really well. But there's other ones that don't go as well, but that one has gone well. And I feel this sense of freedom. So if he says, how about the music? I say, not right now. And he says, oh. And he's clear. I say, and I can say, I'm sorry, because there's nothing wrong with you wanting to listen to your music as much as you do. I think it's great. I just can't take it right now. And so that sense of freedom helps our relationship. But if I stay mute, mm-hmm. when in a relationship, whether it's with a patient or a friend or a family member, when in fact my limits are repeatedly being violated, even on a small way, I'm yeah. losing freedom. I'm imprisoning myself in a set of rules, and it's not natural. So
it really starts to destroy the potential even for intimacy, for connection, for things that feel genuine, that resentment. I was thinking, the idea of wise mind. I've been really lucky in terms of having different models. And one of the most vivid memories I think I've ever seen of the sort of spirit of observing limits was once, I do a martial art called Aikido, and there's once when the big Japanese instructors come from to teach a seminar, there's such formality, and everybody gets tense about doing things right. And there's really this much more of a pull for setting limits, like, you know, you sit down, do this, do that. And I had this friend
what do you mean there's a pull?
There's a pull. Everybody is so on their best behavior. And you know how you get embarrassed when somebody does something that's wrong or poorly mannered in front of somebody else?
If it's part of your group, yeah, right.
Yeah. And so this friend of mine was sitting with his back, chatting along to another friend, not realizing that the sensei had entered the room. And when the sensei enters the room, what you're supposed to do is everybody shuts up and lines up and is very attentive. And he didn't see him come in. And I was watching the instructor. The instructor was getting so, the chief instructor of the school where the seminar was getting so tense red, wanting to set the limit and straighten them out. And what the Anno sensei was the teacher. What Anno sensei did is he walked over to them, behind them, they didn't see him come up, and he reached his arms around so that one hand sat on the outside shoulder of each of them and just gave them a little squeeze. And then they, seeing, oh, it's a problem, immediately self-corrected. And that image for me, the spirit of seeing something that's off, but the way in which I should approach it is embracing, friendly, warm, letting the person see what the problem is. And then it connects, I think, to the way that people naturally don't want to cause each other pain and don't want to, I think that there's a spirit that you can approach of observing a limit that's more embracing and friendly and calls for the other's real desire to have a good relationship. And I just think that image for me, I wondered if you had images like this, but you know, that image for me now is how can I say what I need and want in a way that really includes what the other and assumes they too want a really good relationship. They don't want to be a problem. They don't want us to have tension. Do you have images that are like that for you?
Well, I'll tell you, the image that came up while you were talking, I thought, you know, a good movie to watch about this that I hadn't thought of before is The Sound of Music, because the father of the, is it eight kids? I think.
Yeah.
The captain. I mean, he arbitrarily sets all kinds of limits in the family, you know, and that are intrusive, that are forbidding, and that are, you know, he blows his whistle and they're all supposed to come and they're all supposed to act.
That's right.
You know. And then Maria comes, and she establishes a relationship with all of them as a group and then with each of them individually. And I'd have to look back at the movie, which I always loved and always cried at. It's like a crappy movie. It never fails. And and that she seems to establish a relationship where, in fact, she does get taken seriously. She does mm-hmm. communicate her personal style and her personal limits in this way, but it's very personal, and it's very mm-hmm. genuine, and it is, and she operates with a degree of freedom, but also with concern for how each one reacts. And of course, it's Hollywood, but you know, it does that image of mm-hmm. having. I remember the difference of two psychoanalytic therapists, experts on treatment of borderline personality disorder or organization. One taught me, one big teacher of mine taught me sort of like the prefabricated, here are the limits and here are the rules, and there were a lot of rules and there were a lot of limits. They were kind of forbidding, and I felt they were a little arbitrary sometimes and assumed that everybody's doing things, you know, assumed that, you know, this behavior should be stopped or limited without yet knowing quite what it was or where it was coming from. And then there was another equally prominent person in the world who was another teacher of mine who said, you know, I start out essentially with no limits in the psychoanalytic treatment, and limits evolve as we have, as our relationship evolves. And so I don't bring a limit in ahead of time because I don't even know this person yet and whether they need that. That was very helpful to me because that was a little more my style. I mean, I noticed that I once had an individual I was treating who really wanted to know me better and at a more personal way and would drive by my house and let me know that in sessions, would spend lots of time in the waiting room and see who came and went, and would call me by my first name immediately, very familiar. And I have, for some reason, well, actually, first of all, I have pretty wide limits about those kind of things if they don't violate some essential limit of mine where I feel betrayed or I feel, you know, that it really is a negative consequence to somebody or something with me. And so pretty wide, and, you know, so that I just noticed that those things didn't bother me. I thought, well, what should I do about that? And because maybe that's a problem of mine. But over time, I've come to think, you know, those don't bother me, but other things do bother me that don't bother other people as much. Like, you know, if somebody does anything that really somehow infringes on my treatment of another person, that's very upsetting to me. I'm pretty strict about that. And if somebody, you know, uses information from our sessions in a deliberate way, I won't go into details, but in a deliberate way that somehow creates a really bad image of me to another person who might be treated by me, again, I guess that comes back to the same thing. And to some degree, dishonesty, though I've gotten much more, I guess I've gotten more flexible in how I understand and react to dishonesty. But earlier in my career, that was a tough limit for me. I didn't tolerate much of it, and I've come to think that dishonesty sometimes is a step in the right direction for some people, or is tolerable and isn't so bad, and is something we can work on. So I don't know. Yeah. I think it's a constant. It's a huge focus. You know, it's like one of those things in therapy. I find this about DBT skills too, that sometimes I'm teaching a skill and I get in the middle of it, I think, this is worth teaching for a year.
This touches on
so many things. This is like, shouldn't just be packaged as one of five skills to teach during 1 hour. This is like the whole world. And I feel about observing limits, and especially in the realm of burning out and about parents, or let's say about caregivers of somebody with Alzheimer's or somebody else who, you know, or somebody with really severe disabilities. You know, you really, observing limits is huge. It's the whole ball game for a while. So how to do that well. So I was glad you picked this topic. And I don't know if there's like formal research on this topic.
I looked a little bit for it, and I didn't find a lot. So I think to me, I mean, there probably is, but I didn't find it when I did a quick look. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that you were just saying was making me think of, I think of there being two sort of skills to practice. One is being able on the fly in a very light way when something is a little off to say something right in the moment so that, so that a person stands a little too close and you have that overlearned skill of being able to say, hey, would you mind just stepping back? That's just a little too close for me. Or, that very light ability to make a comment, get back into a good comfort zone, but for your, just being able to phrase it. And I think I think that is something that you can really practice on teams or with other parents or, just what's the quick way of
observing. No, that's a really good point, Kelly. You could really, in teams, you can definitely have practices like this. So you could just have a DBT team members practice observing, pick some limits and observe them with each other in a way that's immediate and intuitive, respectful, matter of fact, and followed by a compassionate, I'm sorry I had to do that, but I really need to do that to preserve myself. Or something like that. And I think parents could do that who are in groups with each other or in a therapy, any kind of support situation. Parents could practice observing limits toward each other or towards their kids in a way that preserves
just that very, and just that very on the fly. I think the other one is the ability to have a real heart-to-heart when, where you're really going to talk it through, like really where your limits actually cause discomfort and hardship and pain for the other. I think being able to tolerate the fact that, in fact, what you want is not what you're willing to give is not what the other person really needs. I think that takes a lot of, to say no to your family member, to say no to a client, where clearly they really would be better if you could take that very late phone call.
I know. I had one experience with my wife about this when early in our relationship. I love watching sports, a lot of sports. I grew up with sports, and she didn't, and it's never something she's scared about doing. And so I wanted her to sit and watch a football game with me or a baseball game or whatever. And it became clear early in the relationship that even though she sat down with me kindly and tried to tolerate watching a football game with me, or even worse, God forbid, a golf match, because I grew up playing golf, and it's unbelievable. If you aren't a golfer, it's unbelievably boring to watch a golf
match. It's terrible. Yeah, I'm with her on this one.
So, imagine what's being asked of you by your partner is, will you watch with me? And you appreciate, oh, my God, isn't that good? He's reaching out to me. I don't want him to feel alone, blah, blah, blah. And so, eventually she communicated in a pretty skillful way at a certain point. I really am not opposed to you watching football or having someone you want to watch with. I can see that. But, it just can't be me. I can't take it. It's sort of like me with my son's music sometimes. And it sounds like a sort of funny example, but actually it was painful. And watching sports with someone else has always been a real thing I've enjoyed. So, that things like that come up all the time. Will you have dinner with me? Will you do this with me? Will you, I wanted us to go to a maple sugar shack today and get pancakes. It happens in New England once a year for a few weeks, and everybody, it's a ritual. And nobody wanted to go with me. And, they were all observing their limits, goddamn them, and I had to figure out how to cope with it. But nobody made me feel bad.
Yeah.
But
I think that is what's hard is that, at least as a therapist often, you're in a position where you really can't, either because you personally just can't go past that limit because of all the consequences for you yourself, or you think it would be in the client's, not in their interest for you to go past like it actually will be better for them in the long run if you hold the limit.
Right.
And I think in say again.
No, I was just going to say, and I think there that you that the thing that's best for both parties is if you can have the ability and the courage, and then you know the self-monitoring to know that this, it is past your limit, and find ways repeatedly to preserve that. I mean, it creates.
Yeah, but it takes so much.
Really good.
Yeah, but I think this is, I guess where I was going with it is it takes so much sensitivity and compassion, both for yourself and the other person, to not deal with the pain of not doing what the other person wants, and then not let them have it. I just think of all the burn unit nurses, you know, where when you see somebody else suffering, like the if a client comes and over, you know, it actually is really painful that you want whatever. And you agree they really actually need it. And I just think, you know, being in a relationship where the interpersonal fit is off genuinely exquisitely painful. And so I think the other nuance, and I'm with you, it's a big topic, but the other nuance that's really, or skill that's needed is the ability to tolerate things being very difficult, like that actually is part of important relationships, that there really, truly are ways that differences exist, and part of having a good relationship is how to be with that.
Yes.
In a way that's
part of it.
Yeah, that works.
Well, my clock tells me we should stop. And
we're right at time, aren't we?
I want to thank you for bringing this topic. I mean, and I think it's a great one. I just want to anticipate that the next one of these for you and me, the Connecting the Dots series, is April 21st, which is, I think, 4 weeks from now. And that weekend is the North American Society for Study of Personality Disorder first annual meeting in Boston at McLean Hospital. And Perry is actually a co-chair of that. I think she mentioned it earlier, but while I was still muted. And so I'm going to be at that and playing a part in that. And I thought that one, because that weekend I won't have much time to prepare for anything else, that I'm going to take off at our thing sort of like we did after the ABCT meeting, like just some highlights.
Yeah, that would be great.
Interesting things that came up, because it seemed like people found that useful when you and I did that. So I'll probably take off things from there, and then we can go from there.
That's a great idea. Okay. Wonderful. Terrific. Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, so, Perry, as always, it's great to have people's feedback if they have anything that resonated or thoughts.
Yes,
or
and I have
like
a letter that I have not received, but the person was at the Los Angeles conference Friday, and she's going to resend it to me, and I will send it on to both of you. And also, thank you for the people who were kind enough to send in donations. I hope everyone else on the call, when they sign off, will do the same thing. That's the only way we can keep these kinds of things going. So thank you. Thank you, Kelly and Charlie, so much for all of this.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
It was
okay.
Very interesting. Thanks.
Take care.
Okay.
Great.
Right.
Okay, we'll see you.
Amigos.
Okay. Bye-bye, y'all.